Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. I'm Peter Schiff. I'm doing a show live from Los Angeles in the 5 p.m. time zone West Coast, 8 p.m. out on the East Coast. The number to call toll-free, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I do the show every Wednesday evening on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, and on my website, www.europac.net. Anyway, we just came back from the San Francisco Hard Asset Conference. A lot of people showed up there. I know when I gave the keynote address and when I gave my special two-hour presentation that we emailed out, we had standing room only, probably 1,000-plus people came into San Francisco. Very, very good turnout if anybody was there. Glad to meet you if you want to call in and talk about the Hard Asset Conference. As far as I know, I'm not sure when I'm speaking next. I think I'm probably, it might be the money show in Orlando. I'm not positive. Although I know I have another speaking engagement coming out in the Saudi Arabia trip that I'm doing in January. Oh, I know I will be on CNN on Friday. I don't think I put that on the website yet. I totally forgot, and I don't even remember what time I'm doing CNN. I think it's in the morning, 10:30 ish or something. I forget exactly. When I look at it, I might put it up on the website. So check tomorrow for when I'll be on CNN. I also had a hit on Bloomberg. I think on Monday I did it out of L.A. I don't know if it's on my website. I know I saw it up on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, I mean, the YouTube clip that I did, about me, the Peter Schiff Was Right one, the views on that now are upwards of 750,000. I think it's going to go over 800,000. There is an article about that video in the New York Times, which is online right now. It comes out tomorrow. NPR Marketplace, which has about 15 million audience, they are doing a 10-minute, 12-minute segment about that YouTube clip that'll going to run tomorrow. So there's a lot more press coverage. I still think ultimately that clip is going to get to over 1 million views, which is pretty remarkable that so many people are able to see it. There was another YouTube clip that somebody else had put together that I thought was kind of interesting. It's not the same person. It looked like it was a different person. It was called Peter Schiff Analogies, and I sent out the link to it. I think it was pretty interesting because, you know, I always talk in analogies. I always try to explain things, complex things by using simple analogies. And so somebody had basically picked up on that and went over a number of different appearances that I've made over the years and just kind of focused on the analogies. And they put them all together in a 9.5-minute clip. And I thought it was interesting because it's good at helping to explain, you know, what's wrong with our economy and why the government policies supposedly to fix the economy are in fact making the economy worse. So that one is called Peter Schiff Analogies, and I think it's, you know, so far it's about 30,000 views. I think pretty much it's been seen by my database. I don't think it's been picked up yet by all the blogs and everything, and, you know, like the other one. I don't know. I think the reason that the other one was so successful, and I don't think this one will be able to generate nearly as much of a buzz online, is I think that, you know, what was so good about the first one, at least good in that it made people want to watch it, it wasn't even so much that I was right about a lot of things. It was more that everybody else was so wrong, and the way they responded to what I said with the laughter and the ridicule. So I think, you know, this one doesn't really have that. It just focuses on my analogy. So, you know, people aren't going to be able to laugh at other people and say, ah, look how these guys are wrong. And I think that's what, you know, really got that thing. People like, you know, people like to look at people who are wrong, I think. Even though the people in that video weren't the only ones that were saying those things. I mean, they're, you know, pretty much everybody, they were just echoing the sentiments of pretty much all the pundits on all the networks. You know, they're the ones that just happen to be included in that video, and they're probably getting ridiculed more than they should, because a lot of other people were saying things just as foolish. They just weren't caught on that YouTube clip. And of course, you know, people generally said their most foolish things when I was on the air, because I was the one who was coming out predicting the gloom and doom, and so they would have to come back and say why I was so wrong. If I wasn't on the air with them, then they wouldn't, you know, have to say those things, because there was nobody else saying what I was saying. So it's just anybody who was unfortunate enough to be on television with me, you know, they happened to be caught at their worst moments, because I forced them to say things extreme that ultimately looked foolish, once everything happened. But also, I know, apparently I haven't heard this. Somebody forwarded me, Mike Norman had said some things again, and I think apparently he's still getting the hate mail. I don't know, but I mean, what we don't want is, I certainly don't want people to look at what these people said on these things and go out of your way to send emails to a Ben Stein or Art Laff or a Mike Norman, you know, negative emails. Oh, you know, you're an idiot, you're a moron. I mean, you don't need to do that. I mean, I don't want, you know, and it gives us a bad name too, some of my fans or me. I mean, there's no reason, they were wrong. That's all. Like everybody else. I mean, they were, you know, as I said, they were no more wrong than the thousands of others who got this completely wrong. They just, A, were not on the air with me, and were not featured in the YouTube clip, because there are plenty of other people who said things, you know, just as foolish as these guys that were on the air with me. They didn't make that clip. I mean, you know, whoever put it together, that's what he happened to choose. But there are plenty of other guys that could have been included, and other big names that could have been on there that were acting just as foolishly. But anyway, but you never want to send negative emails to people. You know, I mean, I get them occasionally myself. I mean, you know, I don't get that many, fortunately. I mean, most of my emails are positive, but, you know, maybe one out of 100 somebody says, oh, you're a jerk, or you're an idiot, you're a moron. But I think you definitely don't want to threaten people. I mean, that's, you know, I think he told me one time off the air that people had given them death threats or something, and, you know, obviously that's out of line. I mean, no matter what people do, you don't want to threaten people, you don't want to threaten their families. But anyway, let's go and, you know, talk about what's been going on in the markets. I mean, again, you know, the news just keeps getting worse. The economic numbers just keep coming out every single day, you know, more horrific than people think. You know, we keep getting new bailout monies. I mean, just in the last week, I mean, you can't even keep track of the hundreds of billions of dollars that gets authorized. I mean, now not only are the auto companies look like they're going to get a bailout, but, you know, now you got all the state governments. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger is declaring, I think, a state of emergency. You had all the governors were meeting across the country with Barack Obama, basically begging for money. And, of course, you know, Barack Obama doesn't have any money. I mean, all they have is a printing press. And basically the state governors are saying, look, you know, we can't print money, you can, so while you're running off all these trillions, you know, can you run off some for us? And that's basically what's going on. And, you know, the printing presses are just going to run a nonstop. And, you know, now that they're going to bail out the auto companies, this is not the end, right? I mean, the government can't say no to a bailout at this point, right? I mean, since Lehman Brothers' failure is now being blame for all the problems, which, of course, you know, the only thing the government did right was not bailing out Lehman. But now, of course, all these problems are the result of the failure to bail out Lehman. So now everybody gets a bailout. But, you know, now that they're bailing out the auto companies, who's next? And where do you draw the line? And the bottom line is, you can't draw the line, because how can the government play favorites? I mean, how can they say, well, this company can be bailed out, but not another company? And, you know, it's amazing, too. They keep going back to the Chrysler bailout of 20, 25 years ago as an example of, you see, you know, the government made money on that one. Well, I beg to differ, because Chrysler is bankrupt again looking for an even bigger bailout now than 25 years ago. So, I mean, how can we say that was a success when they're asking for even more money now? And to say that we made money bailing out Chrysler, we don't know, because we're giving them more money, right? And so we might end up losing. But even if it turned out good, it doesn't excuse the fact that the government had no constitutional authority to do it. We say that we created a bad precedent, and now here we are using that bad precedent as justification for more of the same. And, of course, we don't know. Like, let's assume that the government had let Chrysler fail back then. We don't know if our automobile industry would be like. Maybe it would be stronger. Maybe Chrysler would have become leaner and meaner had they not had the guarantees. Maybe Ford and General Motors would have been in better shape. Maybe they would have picked up some of Chrysler's assets cheap and done a better job. Maybe they would have been more fearful of a potential bankruptcy on their own, and maybe they would have been more responsible. We have no idea what would have happened had the government allowed Chrysler to fail. So to say that this was somehow a success is all a bunch of nonsense. But of course, this is just the politicians trying to justify these bailouts. But the point is, now that we're bailing out Detroit, right? Or I mean, it looks like that's what we're going to do. You know, everybody that comes up, it's like, well, what about me? What about me? Because the main reason that Detroit is saying we deserve a bailout is, well, you gave a bailout to Wall Street. You know, AIG got money. Why can't we get money? That's the mentality, and they're not going to say no. And so everyone's going to get bailed out, but where's the money going to come from? You know, they're going to print it. Now, right now, the Fed is getting away with printing all this money. Why? Because there's demand for dollars right now, temporarily. Because of deleveraging, there is demand for the money the Fed is printing, but it is temporary demand. It is not going to last. And ultimately, all the dollars that are being warehoused are going to come back on the market. You know, this is just, you know, as I said, people are running towards this nuclear blast right now out of sheer rote. But once they figure out that they're, you know, what they're doing, they're going to turn around and then run for the exits. And, you know, also we notice that the custody holdings, if you look at, you know, where you're seeing a huge increase in holdings of U.S. Treasuries, is coming out of the Caribbean islands. Now, obviously, you know, these Caribbean islands don't have, you know, there's no real money there. This is just, you know, funds, hedge funds, or potentially it's Federal Reserve buying in disguise, so it doesn't look like monetization. Although, you know, basically last week, Ben Bernanke came outright and said that, you know, since there's not that much room left to cut rates, we're already at 1%, he basically said, well, what we're going to do is we're just going to buy government bonds. We're just going to, you know, just buy, you know, print more money and buy more bonds. So they're not even hiding it. They're just basically saying they're going to do it. And the ironic thing about it is we had a huge rally in the bond market. Bond prices hit record highs and yields hit record lows because the Fed said they're going to print money and buy bonds. Now, that is not bullish for bonds. It's bearish because it's creating inflation, which undermines bonds. This is not like a stock buyback. This is inflationary demand. This is, you know, this is the worst thing that can happen for the bond market, yet the bond market rallied. So it shows, you know, what's going on right now in the markets has got nothing to do with any kind of real fundamentals. And as I said, you know, the dollar has strengthened recently. This is a gigantic head fake. You know, a lot of people are being fooled, right? They're seeing the dollar is rallying now, and they're jumping to the false conclusion that this crisis must be good for the dollar because the dollar is rallying. That's not the case at all. You know, the rally has got nothing to do with that. And I think that, you know, generally in markets, you know, they want to fool a lot of people. And that's what's happening. And, gold has gone down, and, you know, gold stocks have gone down, and a lot of things have gone down that should have gone up. It doesn't mean that they're ultimately not going to go up. It simply means that a lot of people are going to be forced out of these trades, and they're not going to live to see the profits. Part of that is their own fault because they were too leveraged in the first place. And part of it might have been that they didn't really have the conviction to stick it out. But the people who really understand what's going on, I'm convinced they're the ones that are going to end up on top because they have the conviction to ride this out and potentially the ability to add to positions because they understand the bargains that they're looking at, and they're not going to be fooled by market noise, which is what I think is going on right now. And as far as the stock markets are concerned, it seems like we haven't really been making new lows. The market's, been very volatile. There's big up days, big down days, but we haven't really been making new lows. I don't know if this means that we're in for a more significant short-term rally or if there's another major down leg coming. I just, you know, there's just no way to tell for sure. I think there's a decent chance that we're going to get some kind of rally, especially since I think there's going to be a lot of, euphoria regarding Barack Obama, and I wouldn't be surprised if the markets rallied so that the media can say, gee, this is great, the world, everybody is confident, we got this new team in there, they're going to fix everything, they're going to make it all better, and of course, you know, they're just going to break it further and it's going to be a lot worse, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to see some kind of rally in the stock market, you know, all around the world, I mean, not just in the U.S., but pretty much, you know, everywhere, because everybody thinks Barack Obama is going to save the day, and of course he's not going to do that. The question is now what's going to happen to the dollar. That's a bigger factor here, especially for our portfolios at Euro Pacific. And, you know, the dollar, again, has not made new highs in the past week or so. It seems to be just going sideways. I can't tell for sure whether we're basing for another move up in the dollar, which would further suppress our portfolios, but would create even better opportunities to buy than what we have today. Or this could be indicative of a dollar top. The dollar rally could be over, in which case I would look for a precipitous decline to begin in the dollar once we kind of break down from this pattern, which of course would be very bullish for our current accounts, but would be a negative for people who are yet to get their money abroad, because it would make it increasingly more expensive to get out of the dollar. But there's no way to know what's going to happen in the short run. In the long run, there's no doubt in my mind that this dollar rally is phony, that it has nothing to do with the fundamentals of the U.S. economy. It has everything to do with the noise in the market and the deleveraging and whatever's going on, and that when the dollar rally ends, I mean, whether it's already topped out or whether it's got more upside to go, that when it does finally lose steam, it is going to drop like a rock. And, you know, I think it's going to lose value very, very rapidly. And I think, you know, I think those people who are trying to finesse it, who think that they're going to stay in the dollar and then get out, you know, before it collapses, I think that's easier said than done. And I think people are going to find that very difficult to actually accomplish. I mean, in theory, it works great. The problem is, in practice, you don't know when to do it. And so, you know, I think you need to err on safety. And since we know the dollar is going to collapse eventually, the best thing to do is not to own it. And that way you can assure yourself that you're not in it when it does. If you're trying to time the market, it's possible that you do it right, but I think it's more likely that you do it wrong, and then you end up just as broke as everybody else who didn't see it coming. Anyway, I know we've got some people queuing up, so let me go to the phones. I'll take Steve calling out of New York.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
I got you. You're live on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for spreading the word about the real deal, what's happening out there. I've got a bunch of questions for you, but I'll just pick one. I'm totally on board with your thesis about that the dollar is going to lose substantial value against pretty much everything else, and I'm in the process right now of opening an account with Europac. Now, I haven't thought previously about investing in gold before very recently, so I might have a question for you that might seem a bit naive. Do you see any possibility of a future scenario where people won't look to gold as money, but rather will put their wealth in companies that own commodities that have real value to people, like energy, food?
Well, I mean, but that's not money. Those are investments. I mean, if you're talking about money, right, something that can be readily exchanged, you know, for other goods and services, something that can function as a store value unit of account, that's not going to be a share of stock. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to walk into a grocery store and negotiate, you know, shares of a mining company in exchange for, you know, a loaf of bread. But, you know, so I think that when it comes to money, it's going to be gold. I mean, sure, gold, silver, you know, something tangible. But certainly when people look to make investments, when they look to invest their money and own income-producing assets and brokerage accounts, and they want to own things that will pay dividends, yeah, I think those types of investments are going to do well, and I think people are going to gravitate to them over time.
Okay. And right now, what would you – based on the current market conditions of the foreign equities that are available and gold prices, what – for a conservative investor, conservative to, you know, moderate risk tolerance, what kind of allocation towards gold and gold mining?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you got to make your own, strike your own balance. I mean, you know, I've talked on this program, and I've had about half my account in gold stocks, and, you know, obviously they've taken a huge, huge hit in the last 6 months. You know, so obviously I was overweighted in gold, but I mean, the foreign stocks that weren't gold related have gone down too, not quite as much. But I'm still very bullish, and you know, I think what's happening in the foreign markets, I think, is a great opportunity. I think the prices that we see in many of the stocks that we follow and that we recommend are really just you know, a temporary aberration in the market. You know, another analogy I thought of earlier today is, you know, if you're if you're dying of thirst in the desert and someone comes and offers to sell you a bottle of water and it's the only water that's there and you're dying of thirst, obviously you're going to pay a lot of money for that bottle of water. But under normal circumstances, if you're just, you know, going about your business, you know, in a city, you know, you're not going to pay a lot of money for a bottle of water. You know, it all depends on the circumstances. And you know, right now, if you own stocks and you want to sell, the circumstances are that you're not going to get much money. I mean, that's just the way it is right now. If you want to sell an asset, you're not going to get much for it. But if you can wait until different circumstances, you know, so if you happen to be dying, if you happen to be in the desert and you're not the guy that's dying of thirst, then you don't have to overpay for that bottle of water. You can wait until you're out of the desert. You know, it depends if you know. And so that's the situation for our clients. I mean, they don't have to sell. They don't need the money right now, at least, you know, if they were straight up with me from the beginning, if they only invested long-term money and they didn't, you know, they weren't speculating, they didn't send me money that they needed back in 6 months. If they really were long-term investors, like they said they were, then the fact that our stocks are down right now is not causing any real financial damage to any of the clients. I mean, providing that they come back up, and which is I believe they will, and provided that they continue to pay their dividends, which I believe they will. And so for you, I mean, you know, there's just, you know, for guys that have cash, for people who have more money to invest, which, you know, hopefully is most of the clients, I mean, it is an opportunity, I think, of a lifetime. It's an investor's dream. To be able to step up when so many people are nervous and uncertain and so many people are getting margin calls and being forced to sell and you're looking at prices that are just unreal. You know, I bought some more of one of these REITs myself the other day in one of my accounts, and, you know, just look at it, the yield that they're offering is 27%, and it's like, I can get 27% yield on a commercial property? I mean, why wouldn't I buy that? I mean, and if it goes down, I mean, does it really matter to me if the price goes down? I mean, why should I care? I mean, as long as the yield holds up, I'm going to get all my money back in 3 years anyway. I mean, whatever I pay for the stock, I'm going to get it all back in dividends, and I'm going to free ride on it for the rest of my life. I mean, the ability to collect this kind of yield on an asset is just unbelievable. And even if for some short term, I don't know, maybe if a tenant goes bankrupt and they have to reduce the dividend for a couple of times and I don't get the full 27%, maybe I only get 10% for a couple of times, and then it goes, then they lease the property back up and I'm right back up to a 27%. I mean, do I care? You know, people have to really look at what's going on and look at these real opportunities and stop worrying about, oh my God, yeah, it's 27%, but what if I buy the stock and it goes down? So what? So what if it goes down? And that's the attitude that you have to have. Now, obviously, if it's not long-term money, right, if it's money you need in 6 weeks, then, yeah, it might go down and you can't afford to buy the stock. And you shouldn't invest with money that it's short-term because you're speculating. Now, you could win. I mean, there's so much volatility in this market right now. Any given day, you can buy a stock and it can be 10 or 20% above what you paid for it by settlement date. And so, I mean, this is probably the best market I've ever seen for speculating if you do it right. I mean, we don't encourage people to do that, but I know people are doing it, and some people are making money, and some people are getting slaughtered. But there is incredible volatility, you know, and there's opportunities for people who want to gamble. But I think for people who don't want to gamble, if you have long-term money, I mean, it is an incredible, incredible buying opportunity all around the world.
Okay, thanks very much for your input on that.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Let me go to Steve in Ohio.
Hey, Peter. First of all, I want to thank you for what you're doing right now. I think you and Jim Rogers and Max Keyser are about the only ones telling the truth these days, or at least get it and understand what's going on.
Well, there are a few other people. It's just that they don't make it onto television, or, you know, because we're not the only ones. I mean, I think, you know, certainly there are a number of people that are Austrians as far as their views on economics. I think there are a number of college professors who are not, you know, deans of the biggest business school, you know, schools out there, but they're at, you know, mid-tier schools and who understand this. It's just that the people who really understand economics don't make it to government. They don't make it to the top jobs on Wall Street, and so their views don't get heard. But, I mean, as I said, I'm not the only one that saw this coming. I happen to have been someone who saw it coming in the media. And so, you know, people are saying, gee, all this guy must, you know, how can he know this? But it really wasn't that difficult. It's just that you were comparing my forecast with all the forecasts of everybody else who are basically, you know, brain dead when it comes to economics. I mean, they've all been brainwashed at universities, and they've accepted the Keynesian myth, hook, line, and sinker. And so they're so confused. They've got so much, you know, bad information over the years that they don't know what's going on.
Right. It's too bad Glenn Beck left Headline News, because I think a lot of people could stand to hear what you have to say.
Well, remember, Glenn Beck is coming back on Fox News. I mean, he's not off the air. What happened is he signed a new contract with Fox, and so when he did that, I guess CNN headline kicked him off. But he's going to come back with a probably an even bigger show because I think he'll get a bigger audience, I guess, on Fox News, and he'll be on Fox News sometime in coming up in early in the next year. I'm not sure if it's January or February when it's starting, but he'll be back on, and hopefully I'll be a part of his show.
Well, the sooner the better, because I think a lot of people could stand to hear what you're talking about right now. But a couple quick questions. I'm a young guy. I'm in my mid-20s, and I don't have $100,000 to invest with Euro Pacific. So I kind of had to go a different route.
Well, you don't need $100,000, but, I don't know how much you had, but,
Okay, it's probably around $20,000 or so.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's not a lot of money, right? You can't do that much. I mean, a lot of times it's just, you just buy yourself some gold and silver at that point, and that might be something to do. But, you can certainly build a small portfolio. The problem is, with a $20,000 portfolio, you don't have as much diversification, but it's possible, and it's better than leaving the money in the dollar. But sometimes you can just put the money in gold coins and silver coins, and that's not a bad thing to do.
Well, so far what I did was I put about half of it into gold coins, and then the other half I put most of it into the RIDEX weakening dollar fund and a commodity ETF with wheat, corn, soy, soybean oil, coffee, and sugar. And I'm just wondering, I'm about as bearish as you are as far as, I think next year, the dollar is probably going to drop under the table, and I think the economy is probably going to follow right along with it. If I stick with RIDEX and the ETF, am I basically just going to be holding more worthless dollars if the dollar just gets annihilated?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't really follow funds, but these, I think if it's going to short dollars, then you're going to get more of them. So I mean, you'll have if the dollar collapses, you should theoretically have millions or billions of them. So you'll have some. But I don't know what the counterparty risks are in these types of transactions. I mean, that's the problem with some of these things where they're leveraged and they're artificial. It's because there's usually somebody, there's a counterparty to these transactions, and the question is, if the dollar really plunges, can the other party who sold the dollars to the RIDEX, can they actually deliver the profit to the fund? And so you don't know. I mean, that's a problem. We went through a scare for a while. We had some of these funds that we owned in London, and fortunately they turned out okay and there was no problem, but there are some people who were worried and the prices dropped because their counterparty was AIG, and all of a sudden AIG was in trouble and they questioned whether or not they could live up to their commitments, and so the funds dropped because there was a scare. So I don't know. I mean, you just never know when you're dealing with something that's been synthetically created, what the counterparty risks are. And, I think it's going to be unfortunate for some people and a lot of different things. I don't know about RIDEX, but I think there's certainly going to be circumstances where people think their portfolios are insured or they have a certain investment that they've made, and the market does what they think, but they're going to lose all their money anyway because the company that was providing them with the product or the insurance is just doesn't have the ability to pay.
Right. Well, and that's what I'm worried about. I've been thinking lately, if it may not just be worth it to just liquidate those holdings and just go all in with gold. I mean, I know normally you want to be diversified, but like I said, I'm pretty bearish on what's going to happen here next year and into 2000.
Yeah, as I said, and if you're still young and you're working, you obviously don't need the income. You just have a little bit of savings and you want to keep it. I mean, you have gold and silver coins, and you can also work with the Perth Mint, get some gold out of the country. We do. I think you're fine doing something like that,
You might recommend that versus, if I'm worried about holding the weakening dollar fund and the
yeah, or you can pick. I think so. I mean, I think if the dollar does weaken, ultimately what you're going to see is gold price strengthen. So I think it's kind of the same trade.
Okay, I got one more kind of odd question for you. I was talking with parents, and my stepfather had his 401k in Euro Pacific Capital, and he just recently switched it. What can I tell them? How can I sell them on putting their 401ks into Euro Pacific?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Why don't you has he read any of my books?
No, but I've been looking into picking those up.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I'd introduce them to me through the book, let them look at that, maybe give them the website, let them look at some of the videos, read some of my stuff, and then have them call and talk to one of the brokers to find out a little bit more about what we do. And, you try to educate them, and, I'm sure we can educate them, and ultimately I'm sure we'll be able to win the account, because I think, once somebody becomes familiar with the situation and what we're doing, I think it's a no-brainer. I mean, what to do with your money.
All right, Peter. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for
Thanks for the call, and appreciate the referral if we get your dad on board. Next call. Actually, let me take a quick break. I want to play a commercial and catch my breath, and we'll be right back for the second half of the show.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
All right, we are back. I think next up is Paul, calling from Missouri.
Yes, good evening, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, what currency would you place an emergency fund? And my second part of that is, I'm trying to get my father and my grandmother to get out of the dollar. How would I
As far as emergency funds, I mean, I don't know, the dollar could obviously be one of the currencies. I mean, you're talking about short-term emergencies, and so you might want to have a basket of currencies that would include the dollar in that type of emergency fund. And obviously, if the dollar gets wiped out, if you have some other currencies like the yen or the Swiss franc in there, the yen has been very strong recently. So those are probably good currencies to have in your fund, and if at the time an emergency comes up, if the dollar is strong, then you don't use you leave the yen alone or the Swiss franc alone, and you simply fund the emergency spending with your dollars. And if the dollar is completely destroyed, well, then you draw on the yen or the Swiss.
Okay, and my second question is, my father and my grandmother, I'm trying to get them out of their dollar because they have substantially more assets than I do. Besides showing them your books or anything else, how would I assure them that it's not as big as of a risk to invest in some of these bargain companies over in Asia?
Well, I mean, they just have to understand that. I mean, as I said, they can read the books and understand the principles of investing. And, you minimize your risk, in long-term investing by buying stocks cheap, by collecting good dividends. And, in this market, I mean, everything is going to be risky when you look at it from, the prism of a day-to-day trading band. I mean, there's, right now, everything is going down. I mean, there's no diversification that can help you because whatever you own anywhere in the world, if it has a symbol, it's going down. But this is a unique circumstance, but the fact that stocks have been beaten down ultimately means there's a lot less risk to buying. I mean, in the long run, in the short run, because of the volatility and what's going on, there's more risk. So it means that if you're a short-term investor and you buy now, you run a greater risk of losing. But if you're a long-term investor and you buy now, I think you have a much better chance of profiting and a much smaller chance of losing. And as far as on the currencies, I think, you just have to understand that, there's two types of risks. If you have your money in dollars, supposedly, at least if it's in U.S. Treasuries, let's say, or in, if it's stuffed under your mattress, the risk you run is not that you lose the dollar. I mean, assuming they're not stolen from your mattress, the risk that you run is that the dollar loses its value. So you can have $1 million and you can keep them very safe, and you can still have your $1 million, but if it costs $1 million to buy a pack of chewing gum, it doesn't mean that you did a good job, that you preserved any wealth by just not losing any dollars. If you understand that there's a lot of risk in the dollar and you decide you want to hold other currencies or other assets, then you risk losing dollars. I mean, if you put $1 million into euros, any given day, you might only have $900,000 or $800,000. There's a chance that when you own the euro, you can lose dollars. But from a longer-term perspective, what you've done is you said, look, I think my purchasing power is safer in euros and in dollars, and it's probably a smart bet. But you can build a portfolio of a basket of currencies. You can include foreign stocks and whatever you put in there. And you just have to understand that what you're doing is you're trading the risk of the dollar losing value for the risk of losing dollars. And that's what I'd rather have. I would rather have foreign currencies and foreign assets. I don't care if they temporarily go down, because I know in the long run it's the dollar that's going to get destroyed, and I don't want to own it.
Yes. Singapore dollar and Australian dollar, I'd put those in my basket of emergency fund currencies.
Yeah, Singapore dollar is really good. I mean, it's, you know, and Aussie dollar, you know, has been beaten up a lot recently. So my guess is there's not that much downside left in the Aussie and Kiwi. You know, they're starting to cut rates over there. They cut again recently. But, you know, the rates are still many, many times what they are in the U.S., and I don't think there's that many more rate cuts coming over there. Meanwhile, I think a lot of these rate cuts, I think the damage to the currencies have already been done. I mean, these currencies are down 40%. I don't think there's a lot more downside. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Anyway, but thanks for the call. And next up is it Gabe in Texas?
Hi, hello, Peter. How are you?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm well. My question is, I've got about $65,000 in cash, and the main question is that I own a piece of property in Central Mexico. It's prime real estate. It's worth about $400,000 with a currency exchange rate right now, the peso and the dollar. And I was planning on holding that land for about 10 to 15 years, so that it appreciated in value, because they're developing that part of the city now. The government.
But what's, is it just raw land right now?
It's raw land. Yeah, but it's a hectare of land, which is about 4 acres.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I mean, what I would try to do, probably, I mean, I don't know all the circumstances, but if you can actually sell that land, if you can get a decent price for it, I think rather than sitting on raw land and hoping something happens, you know, if you can, you know, buy real estate, you know, buy some of these, you know, commercial REITs around the world that have just been absolutely destroyed, like the one I, you know, talked about in Hong Kong, you know, which is yielding 27%, you know, why not pick up a fully developed piece of property that you can get dirt cheap, as opposed to holding an undeveloped property and hoping something happens? I think that there are just so many good bargains right now for already developed properties with you know, with good tenants on board that you can buy for next to nothing, that it doesn't seem that it makes sense to speculate on raw land when you've got the better use for the money.
Okay. And the other thing is that my cash right now is $65,000, and I was thinking about just putting it all into silver. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, you know, I mean, it depends. I mean, I'm very bullish on silver. I mean, silver is under $10 an ounce right now, and I think it represents a lot of value here. You know, it was as high as 20. So it depends. You know, if you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket, if that's all the cash you have, I mean, you might not want to put it all in silver. But, you know, I think silver is got a lot of potential, you know, and it'll probably do better than most things that you want to speculate on. But, you know, it depends. I mean, what you're going to do. You might want to have some other metals. You might want to have, you know, maybe put 10 or 20,000 of it into some of the silver stocks that have really been beaten up, because if silver goes up, I mean, it's possible these things could go up a multiple of that. So,
okay.
You know, anyway, and think about the Perth Mint, too. It's a great place. If you're going to have that much silver, if you have $60,000 worth of silver, it takes up a lot of space. It's expensive to store. Having it over at the Perth Mint solves a lot of those problems.
Yeah, we're going to do it through you guys, actually.
Yeah. All right.
And one last thing.
Thank you. Next call is Tony from Florida.
10 to 15 years.
Is Tony online? Or Tori, rather. Tori.
Is it just raw land right now? It's raw land.
Tori, hey, turn down your radio. You're playing back what I already said.
To me, what I would try to do.
Can you turn down your radio, whoever's on the line? Is that Tori? I don't know who that is. Let's skip to Ed in Minnesota.
Just calling with a couple questions and a comment. I'm one of your smaller clients, I'm sure. I got one rolled over at IRA and also a cash account. And my question was, what do you make, if anything, of the fact that the government is putting the car makers through quite a ringer to find out what the viability of their business plan, when they loan that money out for the bailout with no requirement for the banks to tell them, hey, we've got this business.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, I mean, that would be one thing that they could talk about. It's like, hey, you know, there were no strings on the money you gave to, you know, all these banks. You gave billions of dollars to all these lending institutions, and you didn't do anything. And, you know, why is it a different story for the automakers? And, yeah, they've got a point, but, you know, I don't think the government should be bailing them out, period. I mean, so I don't even think, you know, that it should matter. Certainly, if they're going to bail them out, I mean, I guess they have a right to ask for concessions and to try to put some restrictions on the money, the way it's going to be used. But again, I don't like that. I mean, I don't like the government bailing out a company and then trying to micromanage it, trying to give them advice on how to run their business or, you know, how to make cars. I mean, if these politicians knew anything about making cars, they'd be in the car business. I mean, if they knew anything about doing anything, they wouldn't be in politics. They're in politics because that's all they know how to do, which is basically nothing. You know, they can't run their own businesses, so they run other people's businesses into the ground by taxing and regulating them. So we do not want a society where these cronies in Washington, bureaucrats, are trying to run businesses when they're obviously incompetent at doing it. And, of course, they're running businesses without any risk because it's not their money. You know, it's our money. It's taxpayer money. And they're making decisions for political reasons, not for economic reasons. And as I said, you know, none of this worked in the Soviet Union. Centralized government planning has failed everywhere it's been tried. Why do these idiots think it's going to work if we do it in Washington? You know, they're no smarter than the Russians who tried it, or when the Chinese tried it. The Chinese, you know, after decades of central government planning, the reason that the Chinese economy is prospering now is because the government stopped doing that, by and large, and freed up the market to do it. And now, you know, we're doing the opposite.
Yeah, concur with all you said, but I think they got the upper hand on us. The question I had was, and this is my first year investing with you, and I'm taking a beating like everybody, but I'm in it to get the upside someday. And my question is a kind of a nuts and bolts thing. On my forms that I get back, it tells about foreign tax withheld at source and that sort of thing. When it comes to B tax, I'm number one. Will I get a complete tax?
What happens is at the end of the year, when you get your statement, you will get an accounting of how much foreign taxes you've paid. And it'll be part of your, you know, the 1099 a year-end statement. And you simply either, you know, give that to your accountant, or if you're doing your taxes yourself, you know, you can use that as your foreign tax credit, for your taxable accounts. And, you know, for most people, you know, you'll be able to recoup 100% of what you paid in taxable accounts in foreign taxes against your U.S. income taxes. Now, if you don't pay any U.S. income taxes, then you can't get it back because it's a credit against taxes that you pay. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to owe taxes. If you've had taxes withheld from your wages over the years and now you pay foreign taxes, you can actually get a refund. You can qualify for a tax refund based on the fact that you paid foreign taxes.
Okay, I'll be looking forward to it. I pay a lot of taxes, so I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
And the comment I had was, I've been dealing with John Downs all the way through this thing, and John Downs is just an outstanding person.
I'm sitting in John Downs' chair right now in his office, and I'll relay your sentiments to John.
Yeah, tell him I'll see him for another beer and a Mexican dinner one of these nights.
All right.
Okay.
I will.
Yeah, bye.
Take care.
Uh-huh, bye.
Next up, I believe, is Mike from Indiana.
Hey, what's going on, Peter?
Hey, not much. How are you, Mike?
Not bad. Hey, I'm a farmer from the Midwest, and I own a decent amount of farm ground.
Mm-hmm.
What's this devaluation of the dollar going to do to that?
Well, I think, look, I'm very bullish on agriculture. I'm bullish on farming. I think you're in a good business. I think more people ought to go into farming and horticulture and agriculture and those types of businesses. I think there's a whole world out there that's going to want to eat, and you're going to help feed them. And I think what you want to do is just, you know, try to have an efficient farm as you can and try to, run the business and realize that you've got a lot of Americans who are going to be hungry, a lot of people all around the world that are going to be hungry, and you try to efficiently as possible, you know, produce the food and distribute it, you know.
So you think that farmland is going to keep appreciating?
I think so. I think right now probably it's not because, you know, no land is appreciating because nobody has money to buy. But, you know, I think that you don't need to sell it. You just need to operate it. And if you're a good farmer, I mean, I don't know anything about farming. I mean, if I had a piece of farmland, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I'd have to, you know, have to lease it to somebody who did or sell it. But if you're in the business, if you understand, you know, how to farm, I think it's a great business.
Yeah. I got a question, too, on after this deleveraging is done and, you know, throughout the commodity sector. What do you think the ultimate bottom will be in gold and crude?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's just no way to know where the bottom is. I mean, we might be at the bottom right now. And, you know, chances are we're not, but we might be. But, you know, I don't know. I think that ultimately prices are going a lot higher. I think, gold, I think, has held up. I mean, gold, rather, has held up very well. And I think, you know, gold, I don't think it's going to collapse like some of the other commodities. I think gold is held up well for a reason. And I think a lot of people are figuring out that need to store their wealth, and gold is the best place to do it. But oil, I mean, I think this big drop in the price of oil is ultimately going to help sow the seeds for a much bigger oil rise in the future. I think oil is going to go a lot higher now because of this decline than what would have happened had it never fallen. And I think the reason for that is, you know, when you get this precipitous decline, $140 a barrel down to $50 a barrel or lower in a short period of time, that scares the hell out of the exploration industry. That scares the hell out of alternative energy. That keeps capital scared. So you know what's going to happen when oil prices get back above $100 a barrel, which might even happen as soon as next year? People are going to be afraid. People are going to say, you know what? I'm not going to commit new capital to this oil industry. I'm not going to commit capital to alternative energy because, you know what, the minute I do, the price can collapse right back down again. And I think this is putting the fear in a lot of people, and I think OPEC is just loving it because OPEC, what OPEC wants is for people to not believe in high oil prices because they don't want the additional capital being committed to exploration. They don't want the world gearing up with alternative energy. And so when you get these major declines, it scares everybody. I mean, I think OPEC loves it. And I think what's going to happen is now oil prices are going to have to go even higher and stay there even longer before people, you know, have the courage to commit capital to solving that problem.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye.
I think next up is Marty in California.
Yeah. Hi, Peter. How are you? Thanks for taking the call. I had a question in regards to a couple of things. I actually invested $150,000 today at Euro Pacific, and I bought some Perf Mint.
Mm-hmm.
I'm listening to you right now and everything, and you're talking about the stocks and everything. I'm a filmmaker, so as far as this kind of stuff, I feel like just recently I've taken the red pill and just kind of like opened my eyes and everything. So I'm just trying to kind of get into it to make sure that I do the right thing so I can preserve the money and be able to, you know, have it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're doing the right thing. And for those of you who don't understand what the red pill is, it's a reference to the Matrix, and the Morpheus character gives the Keanu Reeves character a pill to take. And when he takes the pill, he is able to come out of his coma or whatever he's in and live in the real world. And that's what's happening when a lot of people basically educate themselves. They read my material and they realize that they've been living in some fantasy world, and now they're in reality. And yeah, you're doing the right thing. I mean, you keep educating yourself, and keep trying to get into precious metals and get out of the dollar, and you know, tell other people about it, educate other people, because you know, the more people who can take these pills, these red pills, I mean, we need more people to wake up out of this slumber and understand what's going on. Because, you know, that's what it's going to take ultimately to change this country. I mean, we are headed in the wrong direction. They are steering this bus over a cliff. And if we're not going to go over that cliff, we need to have enough political will. There's got to be enough people that understand what's going on so we can alter the trajectory of this bus and get them to change course. And so more people have to figure this out, because the politicians have to think that there's some people out there that will actually appreciate a change of direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? In fact, you know, I'm doing what I can. I've been telling all my friends and all the family members that I have. And in fact, the best thing I could do, I had the idea of, because I make features, so I had the idea of making a documentary about it. I go have a meeting with my lawyer. It's a big law firm, you know, very important lawyer. I sit down with him. I'm having a conversation. I'm telling him about what I want to, you know, what the documentary is going to be about and what I think is going on in this world and everything. And what was shocking to me, when I started to just give him the basics, like, for example, like the Federal Reserve is a private bank. Simple as that. And he did not know that. And this is my lawyer. And I was absolutely shocked. And that's when I decided to...
Well, most people don't know that the Federal Reserve is private. But, of course, it doesn't act like a private company. It's been captured by the government, and it's run like a government agency, even though it is, in theory, a private. And, in fact, the reason that it had to be private was because the Constitution did not authorize the government to print money. And since the Fed was given that power, it had to be a private company because the federal government had no power. They couldn't do it. But, of course, you know, the initially when the Fed was created, you know, all the Federal Reserve notes were backed by real money. They were backed by gold. They were backed by commercial paper. It wasn't simply the engine for inflation that has now become. But anyway, hey, thanks for the call, and look, you know, glad to have you aboard as a client.
I just had one question. You were talking about stocks and everything. Is there anything that you think I should diversify from? Maybe take some of that money that I put into the Perth Mint and maybe go into some stocks.
Potentially, but look, I would discuss that with a broker. I don't really have, I have about 10 minutes left of the show, so I mean, potentially you can talk to a broker about other things that you can do besides just having it all in precious metals. But there's not that much money there, so there's not really that much to do. But anyway, thanks for the call. I think we have two more callers online, so that's about all we have time for. So if you're thinking about calling in, wait till next week. Let me take the last two callers, Matt from Ohio.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, it's great to talk with you. I'm a big fan. I suppose you didn't get into economics to build a fan base, but you can count it at least one. So there's that. Couple questions for you. First of all, what do you think about, as far as Asian markets, it seems that a lot of their economies have been built on exporting to the U.S., and there's some fear that they're going to have trouble rebuilding because of...
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, that's something that I write about extensively in my book, and I talk about the myth. I mean, sure, right now they are using their productive capacity to produce products for export, but the productive capacity exists. They don't have to export what they produce. They can consume what they produce themselves. And the real wealth is the production. That's the economic growth. Consumption is simply the benefit. You know, you produce something, you get to consume it. In fact, you know, consumption shouldn't even be included in GDP. You know, 72% of our GDP is consumption. But, you know, when you produce a product, that goes to the GDP. And then if you consume it, if they count it again, then they're double counting it. Production is the key. That's the real wealth. And the capacity is there. And it's simply, you know, retooling or flipping a switch. And, you know, they have the machines, they have the factories. They don't have to produce exactly what they're producing now. They can produce something different. They can produce what their consumers want. They don't have to produce what our consumers want. But there are some, right now, there are certainly some problems around the world. Because remember, America owes a lot of money to a lot of people. And we're broke and we can't pay it back. And so a lot of people are suffering because they lost money loaning money to us. But ultimately, these losses will pass. This is a financial crisis around the world. It is an economic crisis in the United States. The economies, the surplus nations that are producing, that do have the factories, that do have the savings, will continue to generate production and savings, and their economies will ultimately benefit by their no longer lending money to us and no longer exporting to us. It's our economy that suffers because we're off the global gravy train. We don't have the productive capacity anymore, so if the world doesn't supply us with goods, we just have to go without the stuff until we can figure out how to make it ourselves, and that's not easy. And if the world doesn't lend us their money, then Americans can't borrow money anymore because there's nobody to borrow from because we're all broke.
Yep, I certainly agree with that. I was just wondering if it would be a number of years yet before the Asian markets have to restructure their production to do, because I get the impression.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to take long. Look, remember, you know, at the end of the Second World War, you know, we had all of our factories making bombs, right, and jeeps and tanks and fighter planes. It didn't take these factories long to retool to make washing machines and refrigerators and automobiles. It happened quickly. And, you know, we had 10 million men under arms working in the Army. It didn't take long for these people who lost their jobs. Remember, when World War II ended, the people in the Army were unemployed. Right, but they didn't stay unemployed for long. They found other jobs, and the same thing would happen in China. Somebody's going to lose their job in one company, and they're going to get another job. It's going to be quick, and factories will be able to retool rather quickly. It is not this big disaster for the rest of the world because America is broke. It is a big disaster for us because we're broke.
Good point. Okay, very good. Next question. You talked a lot about going into precious metals. Living in the United States, I have a concern, you know, that at some point precious metals will be confiscated because
Yeah, I share that concern. I mean, that is one of the reasons that we are encouraging people to take advantage of the Perth Mint program that we have here, where we're buying people physical precious metals stored in Australia, because I think it's less likely that the U.S. government is going to confiscate it if it's not in this country. I don't know how they can physically require you to bring gold back from Australia and give it to the government. I guess if the gold is already in this country, they can probably force you to turn it over. I mean, certainly if they can put a government agent at every bank and when you go to your safety deposit box, they can seize it. But if you physically have gold stored in Australia, I don't think the U.S. government has any jurisdiction to force you to go to Australia and bring it back.
Right. Now that kind of segues into my next question. I'd kind of looked at the Perth Mint a little bit, and there had been some commentators who suggested the Perth Mint may have loaned out a little bit more of its
money. Well, no, they don't loan out any of their gold. So, I mean, they're not in the lending business. I mean, they're in the mint business. They make coins and bars, and so the money in the Perth Mint program is available to be fabricated. And so, your gold and silver that you have is not sitting there, you know, in a specific bar with your name on it in a specific part of the vault. You have unallocated metal, but your metal is somewhere in one of their facilities, and when you want it, you can get it. Now, right now, what's happened and what's caused some people to jump to the wrong conclusions is if you want to get your metal shipped to you and you want it shipped to you in coins, there's a long waiting list. Not because the metal isn't there, but because the coins are not there. They have to make the coins, but there's such a huge demand right now for small quantity coins because demand for gold and silver is booming all around the world that there's a long wait to get it because it physically takes them a long time to make it. Because it's not sitting there already made. Because the Perth Mint doesn't mint it. That's the point. It's just unallocated, and that's why they can store it for free. And that's why there's no insurance, and that's why there's no shipping. So you save a lot of money, but you give up a little. And what you give up is that if you want your coins immediately, in times where there's a lot of demand for the coins, you might have to wait for them. That's why I don't recommend that people have 100% of their gold in Australia, that you keep some gold coins on your person in your home. So if you do have an emergency where you actually need the coin because you have to, you know, spend it for something, then you can use the coins that you have. But the money that you have in Perth is not the money you think you're going to need, you know, to barter it or to bribe the crossing guard to get out of the country or whatever, you know, people have their physical goal for. This is your long-term savings that you don't need right away, and you want to keep it protected from government confiscation, potentially, so you're keeping it offshore. And you want to keep it safe. You know, you don't want anyone to steal it. But that's another problem. And if you have a lot of gold and it's in your house, I mean, what if somebody steals it? You know, I think it's safe if it's in a government vault in Australia where the government says, hey, you know, we guarantee it's there. And if they don't honor their commitment, you've got private insurance through Lloyd's of London. I mean, where can you get that kind of guarantee, you know, on another storage facility? I haven't found one. So, and I think a lot of people criticize Perth Mint because they're competitors. And it's really a good product. And people might be buying it and it's hurting their business, so the only thing they can do is try to create a fear that there's some kind of a scam there. You know, and I just think, you know, if you have a good product, you advertise your product. If you have an inferior product, then you go negative and you just try to say why the other product is no good.
Okay, very good. Last question. Could you compare the, I had seen some commentary recently about the dollar. And, you know, they're comparing it to basically to Japan in the late 80s and 90s and how Japan's central bank had dropped their interest.
Yeah, is this still Matt from Ohio?
Yes.
Yeah, we're taking a little bit too much time because I have one more caller to go. But I'll quickly say that the U.S. is not Japan. Japan is in much better shape than the United States. We're not going to have the Japanese problem. We're going to have something much worse because Japan was a wealthy nation. Japan had a lot of savings. Japan was a major exporter of manufactured goods. We're not. We're the opposite of Japan. If we follow the big government intervention policies of Japan, it'll destroy our economy, destroy our currency, which is exactly what's happening. Anyway, thanks for the call. Let me take the last caller, which is Frank from Washington.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Good, good. What's your call? We've got about 3 minutes.
Matt stole part of my question. I believe it was Jason Hummel from SilverStockReport.com that was writing about the Perth Mint, whether or not they had the bullion on hand. And since you pretty much explained that one, I'll pass on that. Next question, comment would be Mike Chedlock, I believe, Mitch, you counter some of his rebuttals to your points.
I'm having a hard time understanding your question. I can't make out what you're saying.
I'm asking about your comments with Mike Chedlock, where he's saying, no way, there's no inflation coming where...
Okay, that's just nonsense. There is massive inflation. We are printing money like crazy right now. That is the definition of inflation. Sure, credit is contracting, but money supply is growing. And what's going to happen is, sure, you're going to see prices falling for assets, right? But that's not deflation. Just because stock prices and real estate prices are going down, what people think is going to happen when they think deflation, they think food is going to get cheaper, that consumer goods are going to get cheaper. That's not going to happen. That's happening a little bit right now because of all the going out of business sales. Plus, all these companies are liquidating their inventory because nobody can afford it. But that's not deflation. That is not going to be a persistent fall in prices. It's going to be a one-time event. We're going to be staring in the face at major, major price increases, which are the result of the inflation that the government is creating to counteract the deflationary forces naturally in the economy, which is what happens when an inflationary boom becomes a deflationary bust. But in a fiat monetary system like the one that we have, we risk hyperinflation and runaway inflation. That is the real risk. Anyway, thanks again, everybody. We're running out of time. Again, go to the website, www.europact.net. Call us toll-free, 800-727-7922. Make sure and pick up a copy of Crash Proof or the new Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. I think both those books would make good Christmas presents if you're looking for gifts, so don't forget to buy for your friends. Anyway, thanks again, everybody. I'll be back again next week for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun, a midweek market outlook.